Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
The two presidential candidates have different ideas about conflict in the Middle East.
The past 2 years have proven that weakness only begets violence and war.
We cannot allow ourselves to become numb to the suffering, and I will not be silent.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. How the next U.S. administration could shift Middle East policy. And small earthquakes in Mexico City trigger concern.
People are worried because they're under their house practically.
Also today, Cuba goes dark.
So this has been a real sort of hand-to-mouth struggle to keep the lights on in Cuba over the last year or so.
And the WNBA Finals MVP left the Bahamas as a teen to play in the U.S. Now she wants to help younger players grow without leaving home.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. We begin the show this Monday in Cuba. People there are used to rolling blackouts, but in recent days, it was the entire Cuban electrical grid that went down.
Now, in the midst of all this, Hurricane Oscar has made landfall. Cuban officials say they're making progress on the power problem, but this will not be a simple fix. Emily Morris is an expert on Cuba's economy at University College London's Institute of the Americas. We spoke earlier today, and she explained how this current crisis began.
It's a combination of different factors. One of the power stations goes out of action, and then that puts more burden on the next power station, which then goes out of action. And so there's a kind of a knock-on effect when you have a breakdown in one area, it puts more pressure on the others, and so they break down. Now, quite clearly, underinvestment over very, very many years, a lack of spares is a problem, but also they've had real problems with delivery of oil shipments recently. And so that's actually meant that they've had to close down some of the power stations, or they've had to impose power cuts, rolling power cuts, scheduled ones around the country in order to save fuel. This has been a crisis been going on for a long time. Clearly, the storms haven't helped with the deliveries of the shipments, but US sanctions also mean that it's very, very difficult for them to process payments. It's very, very difficult for them to find ships that are prepared to bring oil to them. It means that the supply of oil has been constantly interrupted. It means that their foreign exchange isn't sufficient to cover it. It means that they can't get credit. So this has been a real, you know, sort of hand-to-mouth struggle to keep the lights on in Cuba over the last year or so.
And what has happened that has meant fuel supplies to Cuba have not kept up with demand?
Venezuelan shipments have gone down, so then they had to look elsewhere. So then part of the solution was Russian oil. The Russians want to sell their oil, the Cubans want to buy it, but then you have to get ships to bring it across. They're, you know, casting around for other suppliers, and it's very, very difficult because the ships that bring the oil have to be insured. If they're insured by US companies, then they're liable to sanctions. So that actually means that there are fewer ships to bring fuel to Cuba. I've even heard of a case where they were trying to pay one of the suppliers, but the banks wouldn't process the payment, so the supplier wouldn't deliver. Mm. And that is an enormous problem for Cuba because the international banks are what they call overcompliant, and they won't process payments from Cuba.
And then there's the age of Cuba's electrical grid. How old is it, and what's prevented the government there from updating it?
Well, if you look at the Cuban economy, really for the last 30 years has been struggling to recover from the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And then, you know, when there was a recovery, there was a large investment in the early 2000s, which they called the Energy Revolution, where they did some repairs, improved the grid. But most of the major plants are more than 30 years old. And they're, you know, held together by ingenuity and, I don't know, elbow grease. You know, they have to struggle to keep them going.
Emily, how are Cubans responding to this situation so far?
A lot of them are very frustrated. It's extremely difficult. It's for huge hardships. I mean, you know, if you've got an electric cooker, you can't even cook your food. If you've got a fridge, the food is going off. In that climate, if the fans go off, then the mosquitoes come. I mean, it's really very, very difficult to manage. And so there are outbreaks of frustration. But there's also an awareness that there isn't much that can be done despite the kind of awful weekend of, you know, false starts. You know, it's coming back on and then it went off again and then it came on again, then it went off again. People are incredibly patient. The general kind of feeling is one of resignation and kind of stoicism.
That's Emily Morris. She's an expert on Cuba's economy at University College London.
At the age of 83, the Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen has died in exile in the United States. Before Gulen fled home and settled in Pennsylvania, he played an outsized role in politics in Turkey. He was accused by the government there of plotting an unsuccessful coup in 2016. Gulen always denied being a part of any takeover attempt. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul.
Fethullah Gulen isn't a name you hear often in Turkey. His websites and social media are blocked. The schools his organization used to run have been closed. To the Turkish government, 83-year-old Gulen was a cult leader, the mastermind behind a terrorist organization they call FETÖ. And that is a name you hear a lot.
Bu karanlık örgütün lideri ölmüştür.
In a press conference today, Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan commented on his death.
Binlerce gencimizi kutsal değerler adına kandırarak saflarına katmış.
He's saying here that Gulen's organization deceived thousands of Turkish youth in the name of sacred values and turned them into a war machine, betraying their homeland and their nation. But not long ago, Gulen was a powerful ally of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So how did we get here?
The movement's main goal was to, in their own words, to rebuild an ethical society where justice prevailed.
Gonul Tol, who directs the Turkey program at the Middle East Institute, says Gulen's version of Sunni Islam came from the Nurcu movement. He and his followers built a network of schools, businesses, and media organizations in Turkey and over 100 countries. They offered scholarships to low-income students. They used this to build their influence.
Gulen saw secular education as a critical tool to provide upward mobility to his followers and prepare the next generation of rulers.
Successful Gulen students went on to win posts in the government, police, judiciary. And this, Tol says, is where things started to go terribly wrong.
He embedded himself and his movement in the Turkish bureaucracy.
Gulen actually helped President Erdogan consolidate power in Turkey.
Soner Çaptay leads the Turkey program at the Washington Institute and has written several books on Turkey's president. On behalf of Erdogan, Çaptay says Gulen aligned police and judges, prosecuted critics of the government, tapped their phones. But at the height of Gulen's power, he and Erdogan had a falling out.
Gulen, I think, at one point felt so powerful, even against Erdogan, that he wanted one of his followers to head Turkey's spy agency, MIT. I think that was too much even for Erdogan.
In July of 2016, a bloody military coup shook Turkey to the core. In archive footage aired by TRT, Turkey's public broadcaster, people flee coup-linked soldiers who had opened fire on civilians marching in support of the Erdogan government. More than 250 people died that day. Thousands were injured. Many of the officers involved were linked to Gulen.
There does seem to be evidence that the Gulen movement was involved in the attempted coup.
Emma Sinclair Webb directs the Turkey program at Human Rights Watch. She says that in the months and years that followed the coup attempt, the Erdogan government imprisoned or blacklisted tens of thousands of suspected Gulenists, including some 130,000 civil servants. Some were prevented from getting passports, forcing them to stay inside the country. Others were extradited from abroad.
We've seen people being abducted in countries and brought back to Turkey to be imprisoned and put on trial. And so this is a very, very dramatic and continuing story of persecution of the group.
Many of these trials are still continuing, Sinclair Webb says.
It would be wrong to say that, therefore, every single person who has any link with the group was involved in the coup or knew about the coup or thought they were involved in something that could turn out to be responsible for plotting a coup attempt.
Until his death, Gulen denied any involvement in the 2016 coup attempt. But Soner Çağatay says he had little support from either side of the political spectrum in Turkey. Erdogan's supporters, for example,
they hate Gulen because Gulen tried to kill Erdogan, a leader that they love. The other half of the country that dislikes Erdogan hates Gulen even more because Gulen empowered Erdogan.
Gulen never married and never had children. His nephew, Kemal Gulen, broke down in tears while speaking about his uncle to a Turkish independent outlet, Bold. He's saying that Gulen's movement hopes to continue in peace and that they will not engage in a reactionary attitude. Gonul Tol says it's unlikely a new leader will emerge to replace Gulen.
They are now incredibly weak. They are suffering financially. They have been suffering from fractions within the movement following the coup attempt.
A statement put out by the Gulen organization remembered his legacy as one of education, service, and dialogue, and asked supporters to pray for peace and tranquility. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Game 5 of the WNBA Finals last night was a classic nail-biter decided in overtime.
Carlton lobs it in, taken away by Davis. Off to Stewart. 28 years in the making, the New York Liberty are WNBA champions.
The New York Liberty came from behind to beat the Minnesota Lynx. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the game's MVP and her roots.
Confetti fell as New York Liberty players gathered on the court in their freshly printed 2024 WNBA champion t-shirts. 6'6" Jonquel Jones hoisted the trophy. The power forward won MVP of the tournament.
I could never dream of this. I mean, it's...
Jones has been dreaming of this for nearly two decades, though, ever since she left her home country of the Bahamas at age 13. She came to the U.S. to play basketball.
I moved over and I lived with strangers, and those strangers became my family. And Coach Rich is here today. My mom is here today.
The coach she's shouting out there is Diane Richardson, who coached the athlete back in high school in Maryland and became the teen's legal guardian so she could stay here. Since then, basketball has taken Jones around the world, to Bosnia and Herzegovina, to South Korea, Russia, and Turkey. Along the way, she's never forgotten the Bahamas.
The islands have been just ravaged by the hurricane.
In 2019, she raised money to help the islands recover from Hurricane Dorian. And on the 50th anniversary of Bahamian independence, Jones lit up the Empire State Building in the nation's colors.
Happy independence! Happy
independence! At a press conference last month, she said she's proud to represent the Bahamas every time she steps on the court.
I understand how special it is to be the only Bahamian in the league, and you know, hopefully I'll be able to open more doors for other young ladies coming up, you know, who want to be in my shoes one day. But I understand that I'm a role model for a lot of them, and I don't take it lightly.
Bahamian journalist Sasha Lightborn says Jones very much is a role model back home.
That atmosphere last night was unlike anything that I've ever experienced in my life.
Lightborn sat down with Jones after the buzzer. The 30-year-old said she's going home to celebrate regardless, but she really wants a parade in her hometown. Head coach Sandy Brondello agreed at the postgame press conference.
No, definitely. Well, I think we need to have a parade in the Bahamas. Let's go.
Jones herself used the press conference to call for more investment into Bahamian sports, especially for young girls.
You know, I want to make it my mission to really just help grow the game in the Bahamas because we have so much natural talent and so many people that come out of the Bahamas just, you know, go to the U.S. and go to school and end up being really successful. But I think for me, I would want it to be that kids would be able to stay home in the Bahamas and be with their families and still be able to have the opportunities to come over to the U.S. and play professionally. So I think that's the next step that we would have to take.
Jonquel Jones is far from the only international presence on the winning team, though. Coach Brondello is Australian, guard Ivana Dojkic is from Croatia, and there are two key players from Germany. They were honored after last night's win, too.
I do believe a piece of this trophy will have to go home to the German national team because Niara Sabali and Leonie Fibisch were crucial parts.
Sabali had one message for people watching back home.
Immer weiter, wa?
Translation... Keep going. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
With wars in Gaza and Lebanon, along with expectations that Israel will soon attack Iran, whoever wins the U.S. presidential election is likely to inherit a colossal foreign policy challenge in the Middle East. To hear about how Kamala Harris or Donald Trump would handle that challenge, we reached out to two of their former advisors.
We'll hear from someone who advised former President Trump on Middle East policy ahead in the program. But first, Haley Schäufer served as National Security Advisor to Kamala Harris in the U.S. Senate. Schäufer is now the CEO of the Jewish Democratic Council of America, which has endorsed Vice President Harris. Haley Schäufer and I spoke on Thursday. Haley, when Vice President Harris talks about the Israel-Palestinian conflict, her policy views seem largely in sync with President Biden's. You worked closely with then-Senator Harris on Middle East policy. Based on your experience, where would her policies differ from President Biden's if she becomes president?
Well, you're absolutely right that in this White House, there's no daylight between Vice President Harris and President Biden's position with regard to the Middle East and specifically the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Having worked for then Senator Harris, I can tell you that she entered this White House sharing President Biden's views with regard to such conflict. She is a staunch supporter of Israel, its security, and its right to self-defense. I saw that firsthand working for her in 2017 and 2018, traveled to Israel with her, and she is someone who deeply understands the myriad of security challenges that Israel faces on its borders and has stood with Israel as it faces an escalation of those threats. So that's where she is. And I expect that if she's elected president, that that policy will continue.
It appears, though, that the U.S. has not had or has not chosen to use leverage with Israel. The Biden administration has been frustrated with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to news reports. And there's been a real lack of trust between Netanyahu and President Biden. If Harris were to take over as president, how do you think she would handle the relationship with the Israeli Prime Minister?
She's met with Prime Minister Netanyahu as recently as July when he was in Washington. They met at the White House for over an hour. She's joined over 20 of President Biden's calls with Prime Minister Netanyahu. But she's also been asked point blank about this, and she has underscored her commitment to the U.S.-Israel relationship, which of course goes beyond just whomever is elected as Prime Minister. It includes the vital security relationship between the United States and Israel.
Do you think a President Harris would consider putting conditions on American military aid to Israel?
Since October 7th, she strongly supported now the $17.8 billion that this White House has given to Israel. And this has included the flow of a very advanced military weapon systems, including a very advanced missile defense system that was just deployed. Along with it comes 100 troops as well. So I foresee that level of support continuing if she's elected president.
When Harris talks about the Middle East, she seems more inclined to highlight the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza than President Biden has been. Here she is speaking in August.
We cannot look away in the face of these tragedies. We cannot allow ourselves to become numb to the suffering. And I will not be silent.
Harris has said Israel isn't doing enough to ease what she called a humanitarian catastrophe. How would this empathetic language translate into policy?
Well, we've already seen the United States continue to push Israel to ensure the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. It is critically important as there is a growing humanitarian crisis there in terms of food supplies, medicine, and other humanitarian needs. Of course, it is difficult to provide such aid in Gaza because Hamas, a terrorist organization, controls it and has even diverted some aid.
I also do want to mention, though, that David Satterfield, the Biden administration's special Middle East envoy for humanitarian issues, says that Israel has not shown evidence that Hamas is diverting UN aid in Gaza.
Well, it's an incredibly difficult and complicated situation when you're talking about assistance going in to an area that's controlled by a terrorist organization.
A lot of Americans, and that includes a lot of people who tend to support the Democratic Party, are horrified about how Israel has conducted this war in Gaza. They are especially troubled by the high numbers of civilian deaths, and they're laying at least some of the blame at Joe Biden and his administration's feet. What can you see Kamala Harris doing differently?
Well, as I said, it's important to ensure that there's not suffering of innocent civilians on the other side in Gaza, and we support humanitarian assistance going into Gaza. But the reality is that there needs to be a ceasefire agreement that's reached. Those hostages need to be released immediately, and this war must end.
Finally, in the Senate, you worked beside then-Senator Harris when she served on the Select Committee on Intelligence. Could you give us an example of something you saw her do that reveals how she might be able to bring change to the Middle East?
Well, it's important to remember that then-Senator Harris arrived in the Senate the same time that Donald Trump arrived in the White House. This was January of 2017. And she immediately got to work on the Intelligence Committee on a multi-year investigation looking at Russia's interference in our 2016 election on behalf of Donald Trump. So she supports the strength of our democracy. Whereas Donald Trump, you know, he has said he wants to be a dictator, and he himself has praised dictators and aligns with dictators like Vladimir Putin. So the contrast between their views when it comes to national security and foreign policy could not be more different. When it comes to the Middle East, she's been very clear that she will continue to ensure that Israel has the ability to defend itself against the threats that it faces, Iran and Iranian proxies, including Hezbollah and Hamas. She's been absolutely clear. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has not been as clear. His former national security advisor, John Bolton, said that his support of Israel would not be guaranteed in a second term because he only does what's good for Donald Trump. We even saw that on the presidential debate stage when Vice President Harris laid out a very clear policy with regard to Israel, and we heard very little from Donald Trump other than saying that if he were not elected, that Israel would cease to exist, rather ridiculously saying that Israel's future and existence, survival, is contingent on his own political future, which is just ridiculous. It would be laughable if it weren't so serious. So they just could not be more different.
That's Haley Seufer. She was a national security advisor to Kamala Harris when Harris was a U.S. senator.
Ridiculous was the word used there. You can imagine that Trump supporters see it differently. Still ahead this hour, a former advisor to Donald Trump outlines why he's supporting Trump and how he expects a second Trump administration would approach the conflicts in the Middle East. More global news coming your way in the show today. You're listening to The World. An indigenous community in northern Mexico has produced marathon runners famous for their distinct clothes and footwear they put on for certain races. Running in traditional sandals is part of the culture, but some marathoners want to say goodbye to the old and make some changes. That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. When the government in Chile decided to increase public transportation fees, it sparked anger and frustration that exploded into a nationwide protest movement. That was back in October of 2019. The demonstrations were the largest in Chile since the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. People protested for months and demanded a transformation of their country's political system. But 5 years later, the legacy of that movement is not so simple. Michael Fox has our story from the Chilean capital, Santiago.
Last Friday, protesters marking the anniversary of the 2019 uprising met a similar response from Chile's military police, tear gas and water cannons.
La policía sigue con la misma táctica de...
The police have continued the same tactics of repression from the times of the dictatorship, says Ramona Safart, a human rights observer in the crowd. She's part of a group that calls themselves the Blue Helmets. I ask her what this fifth anniversary of the 2019 uprising means to her. Silence, she says. The great majority of the people are frustrated, she says. This place should be packed, but the people don't go out because of fear, because we haven't achieved anything. People throughout the country believe they're worse off than 5 years ago. Alexis Garay is a 24-year-old electrician. He says the protests only made things worse. Everything is worse. Everything is more expensive, he says. Rent, food prices, it's hard to find a job. Everything's worse, much worse. The problem is that none of the reforms that were called for during the 2019 protests came to fruition. The country tried to rewrite the Constitution twice. Chileans voted down both attempts in 2022 and 2023. Without these reforms, the legacy of former dictator Augusto Pinochet runs deep. He ran Chile from 1973 until 1990. His government wrote the 1980 Constitution, locking in a free market economic model that many say caters to the elites and the businesses. Nick McWilliam is the British director of the documentary Santiago Rising about the 2019 protest movement.
Chile's education system is the education system created under Pinochet. Chile's healthcare system is the one created under Pinochet. The anti-trade union laws, the anti-environmental laws, the use of anti-terrorism legislation against Mapuche activists is a Pinochet law.
These are all things the members of the 2019 uprising fought to change with no luck. McWilliam returned to Chile last year. Things had gotten worse.
The bread had doubled in price. The rents had skyrocketed.
One thing that did come from the 2019 uprising, President Gabriel Boric.
Carabineros tiene no solamente todo nuestro respeto.
Boric is a former student leader and congressman who rode the protest wave to power with the promise of rewriting the Constitution. But many progressives say he's turned his back on them. That's him on the anniversary of the 2019 protests 2 years ago, defending the military police crackdown on protesters. Analysts say he's found that his most successful path now is in the middle, the road of least resistance. As for the protests, according to a recent poll, less than a quarter of the country now looks favorable on the 2019 uprising, down from over half in late 2019. But Chilean media professor Jorge Saavedra says this is in part due to the continual demonization of the uprising by political leaders, influencers, and the press.
Estamos como estamos por el estallido. El estallido fue violencia.
They say that we are where we are because of the uprising, that the protesters just caused violence, that they destroyed everything, that they're nothing more than vandals, says Saavedra. But behind this, there's a hidden message. They're telling the people to never again rise up, because you'll hurt the country.
Lo que creo que sería una pregunta mucho más honesta es preguntarle a las personas.
Saavedra says that a more honest question would be, do you believe the social conditions that led to the 2019 protests still exist? He says that a majority of the population would respond yes. The country is clearly divided. Regional and municipal elections are later this week, with presidential elections on the horizon late next year. But there's no clear road ahead. More than a third of the country remembers dictator Pinochet in a positive light. Street vendor Iris is one of them. She's run a kiosk downtown for more than four decades. She declined to give her last name. The armed forces have to take power again, she says. They can clean up this mess, she says, referring to the protesters, crime, and the country's woes. Despite the lack of concrete reforms post-2019, many say there have been gains. Feminist and women's rights were lifted to the fore. Mapuche community members say they're treated with more respect. One sign hung from a building alongside Friday's march. It sums up both the sentiment and the tension over the complicated legacy of the 2019 protest movement. It read, "The 2019 uprising was epic and just. We have nothing to regret." For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Santiago, Chile.
And now a few headlines from Down Under.
King Charles's visit to Australia's parliament was interrupted today when a lawmaker shouted at him about Britain's colonial legacy there. Lydia Thorpe, who's an Indigenous senator and activist for Aboriginal rights, was escorted from the chamber yelling, "This is not your land. You are not my king." Charles's visit has kept alive the longstanding debate in Australia about the role of the British monarchy.
Sometimes you need to hug it out, but apparently not at the airport in Dunedin, New Zealand. Signs have gone up outside the departures area saying that goodbye hugs need to be 3 minutes or less. That's according to Radio New Zealand. The airport director says he himself is a hugger, but they needed to do something to keep traffic moving.
Also in New Zealand, what a weekend for sports. The country won the America's Cup sailing race. Kiwi women beat South Africa in the Cricket World Cup, and the men's cricket team beat India in India. New Zealanders also racked up world championship wins in triathlon, track cycling, and the tantalizing sport of canoe polo. The country's sports minister crowed, "This was a weekend that will go down in New Zealand's sporting annals."
And that's a few things from Down Under. People in Mexico City have been speculating about what's behind recent seismic activity there. On social media, some are expressing their concerns about a new volcano forming nearby. Scientists at the National Autonomous University of Mexico have said that could happen maybe 800 to 1,000 years from now. But that last part about when can get lost in the online chatter. Anna Lillian Martin is a volcanologist at the university.
Mexico City has small earthquakes. I mean, it's had it for decades. And of course, people are worried because they're under their house practically, some of the people in the western part of the city. Now we have more information. These are small earthquakes that are generally about magnitude 1 or 2. A few are magnitude 3, which are totally different from the seismicity we would get from new magma moving.
Okay. These are relatively small tremors, but people can feel them. And in news reports and on social media, there is this speculation that this seismic activity is connected to a potential new volcano. You have already said that's not consistent with what you're seeing. But what is the real story here about a potential new volcano forming in the area?
We have several papers in Journal of Volcanology on the possibility of a new volcano forming, because the Chichinautzin volcanic field, which is to the south of Mexico City, we have like 300 small volcanoes. So it's a potentially active field, which means it's not going to erupt tomorrow, but in the studies that we've done, it could be several hundred years before we have the birth of a new volcano.
So you and colleagues have said that this new volcano might form several hundred years from now. How sure can scientists be about that kind of timing, and how much advance warning could modern seismology give about a potential eruption? Is this the kind of thing that people in the area will know about well ahead of time?
I think so, because these volcanoes, they give you warning because they have to crack through the crust to come up. So that seismicity is going to tell us normally, I think, something like 6 months before we probably see something. We have different kinds of signals within the seismicity that tell us different things. So when it's cracking, it tells us one thing. And when there's liquid going up there, you can also see that in different signals. So this joint information is probably going to tell us when a new volcano would be born.
Interesting. So you have made it clear that the recent seismic activity that Mexico City has seen is not the type that you would see with an impending volcanic eruption. But it seems like, you know, every time there is seismic activity, people chatter about this in Mexico City. Do you think that social media is changing the way that people talk about and understand science and research?
Oh, sometimes. It depends on who's giving the information on social media. I think sometimes there's a lot of really excellent information that you can see in some of the videos and things. And sometimes I'm worried about some of the influencers that give information which is totally different from what we say. So it depends on who gives the information.
Right. So what is it like for you as a researcher when folks go online and speculate about something that is definitely not happening, which you know as a researcher, but the chatter still continues? Is that frustrating?
Well, we normally try to straighten it out. It depends on how important it is. Sometimes if you spend a lot of time correcting things, it just gets more information on what's wrong. What we try to do is to send people to look at the correct instances that could give you correct information, such as the authorities in Mexico City from Civil Protection or CENEPRED, which is a protection agency for the country, and, well, the Institute of Geophysics, which we do a lot of volcanic monitoring. So we always send people to the original source.
Anna Lillian Martin studies volcanoes at the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City.
Ciudad Juarez in Mexico is right across the border from El Paso, Texas. It usually makes headlines with news about immigration and security, but our next story is about something else. The city's marathon. It's famous for having an indigenous category and attracts people from the Tarahumara tribe who live in the mountains of the state of Chihuahua. The Tarahumaras have a tradition of running long distances in sandals. They inspire the barefoot running trend around the globe. But as the world's TBS Isaiah reports from Ciudad Juarez, a new generation of Tarahumaras would prefer to compete in different shoes.
It's easy to spot the Tarahumaras along the route of the Ciudad Juarez Marathon. They run in their traditional clothes, which for women is a long and colorful dress, and for men, a cotton breech cloth and a puffy blouse. For footwear, sandals. They make them with rubber soles and leather straps. And they call them huaraches. Long before marathons existed, the Tarahumara people were already running. They named themselves Raramuri, which means those of light feet. They are used to running to cope with scarcity and isolation in the remote mountains of Chihuahua. 35-year-old Veronica Palma grew up in this community. She says the only transportation available when she was growing up was your feet.
Hay que caminar para ir a buscar agua, leña. Y pues cuando íbamos a la tienda, también hay
She would walk to get water, firewood, to go to the shop.
Sabe que mi abuelo y mi abuela estaba muy lejos.
And she remembers going to visit her grandparents in a different town, also by foot. It was a 10-hour walk, one way.
Salíamos temprano, todavía no salía el sol, estaba oscuro.
But she wouldn't complain. I always loved running, she says. I would feel like I was flying. The faster I ran, the less I would feel the soil. Palma moved to the city of Ciudad Juarez when she was a teenager, and she continued running there. But she found out running in sandals on the pavement was painful.
Tenía lastimados los dos talones, y donde un doctor me dice que debo de cambiar de
After she hurt her feet a few times, the doctor recommended that she wear running shoes. She got used to them and she'd sign up for every race she could. She was running faster now and became an international ultramarathoner and a beloved champion of the Mexican people. She still likes participating in the Ciudad Juarez Marathon every year, where she runs with her fellow Raramuris, but she has an issue with this race.
Piden que debo de correr con mi traje típica, mi traje indumentaria y con calzado de huarache.
It makes it mandatory for indigenous people to run in their traditional costume, which means sandals that hurt Palma's feet. Federico Mendoza, one of the organizers of the marathon, defends this rule.
Ellos están acostumbrados, es como se les facilita más y siempre han corrido así.
He says the Tarahumaras are used to running in sandals and it's easier for them. For him, the rule is aimed at preserving the tradition for this tribe and exhibit it to other attendees. And some Raramuris do prefer huaraches. I asked some runners yesterday, right after they completed the race.
¿Huarache o el tenis?
No, yo no sé. Yo nunca he usado tenis.
Juan tells me she's never used tennis shoes.
Sí, más aire. El tenis no entra aire.
Another says huaraches have better ventilation. And a woman told me she can't afford running shoes.
Sí, no, pero a veces los tenis están muy caros.
Sometimes they are very expensive, she says. Some others prefer huaraches even when they recognize they are less comfortable because they like honoring their ancestors' tradition. But a growing number of Tarahumara runners say they would actually prefer to run in a more comfortable shoe.
Yo digo que si hay un poquito de desventajas en ese aspecto porque es un poquito doloroso para los pies.
Alberto Ramos says it puts us indigenous runners at a disadvantage because it's painful for the feet and makes us run slower. Plus, the winner of the indigenous race gets only about $500, which is 10 times less than what the winner of the general category gets. This is because the marathon waives the $30 registration fee for indigenous people and covers their travel expenses for one night. And for Sombra Ramuri, this is a good enough incentive to accept the rules. Yesterday, Veronica Palma ran as an indigenous in sandals.
Veronica Palma Cruz.
And she won the first place in this category and 14th in the overall race of 3,500 people. But she hurt her feet. It always happens when I run in huaraches, she told me after the race. Her feet were bleeding and swollen, and she took the sandals off in the last mile, wrapped her feet in bandages, and finished the race barefoot. But Palma says she will keep running in this category in solidarity with her fellow Raramuris. Now she wants organizers to let people decide what type of shoe they want to wear because...
Un calzado no tiene nada que ver. Yo siempre voy a hacer lo que soy y de donde...
A shoe doesn't have anything to do with who we are, she says. I will be a Tarahumara no matter what. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Ciudad Juárez, Mexico.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The next U.S. president will set policy to address a dangerous moment in the Middle East. Earlier this hour, we heard from a supporter and former advisor to Vice President Kamala Harris. Now we'll hear from a supporter of former President Donald Trump.
Richard Goldberg served on the National Security Council under Trump and is now with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. We spoke this morning. Richard, you were a key figure in shaping the Trump administration's Iran policy. Based on your firsthand experience, what would the pillars of a second Trump administration's policy on the Middle East include if he returns to the White House in January?
Well, obviously, we have to listen to what the president, former president, is saying right now. And you've seen some of the interviews he's given. He just gave another interview to an Arab language television station based out of Saudi Arabia. So now speaking sort of into the region, speaking to the Saudis as well, as far as what he's thinking about. And all the tea leaves tell us a return to the framework that he had established and that he certainly believes to be a successful framework from where he left off, and that is some combination of maximum pressure approach on Iran, political pressure, economic pressure, potential military threat as well, combined with support for Israel and looking to expand the Abraham Accords. Now, that's easier said than done when you have a lot of things that have changed. We have the Houthis that are more dangerous than they were 4 years ago. That will have to be dealt with potentially militarily in a more escalatory way than we've seen over the last few months. And of course, Iran itself is much farther along on its nuclear weapons potentials and its ambitions.
What policies would President Trump implement that have not already been tried by President Biden for the current tension and crisis?
He truly does internalize the idea of power projection in the United States, of appearing strong, being willing to use force, being committed to your allies and partners. And so there may need to be the use of force, as I said, against the Houthis to restore stability in the Gulf. But that could also be sort of a tipping point to demonstrate to the Saudis and the Emiratis that America is back and willing to assert its role as a security broker in the Middle East. That could be a way of, again, saying, you know, we're not going to push away the Saudi leadership as what happened in the first couple of years of the Biden administration. We're going to bring them closer. We don't want them aligning with China in a 21st century Cold War dynamic. And therefore, we are going to make certain security commitments to Riyadh, to Abu Dhabi, to Manama in Bahrain.
Help us understand what you're talking about, that Trump power projection, what that could mean like right now. If Trump were president right now, how aggressively would he be urging Israel to attack Iran, do you think?
Well, you've heard already that President Biden has been advising Israel not to do things, be constrained, move to ceasefires, de-escalate. President Trump believes that Israel would be better off doing the opposite. You've heard J.D. Vance say if Israel is going to hit Iran, they should do it hard so that you really remove the threat. And so I do think that there is a lot of latitude and support for the Israelis to do what they believe is necessary to restore their own deterrence in the region and remove the most existential threats and dangers that they face.
Donald Trump has described himself as the best friend Israel has ever had. I want us to hear a clip of him speaking earlier this month.
The October 7th attack would never have happened if I was president. The past few years have proven that weakness only begets violence and war.
Richard Goldberg, I want us to turn to another rally when Trump supporters began chanting Genocide Joe. So that's a phrase used by people who accuse President Biden of not reigning in Israel on Gaza. Trump let the chant continue. Then he said, they're not wrong. What was Trump trying to get across here, do you think?
That part, I don't know. I've not heard that. That's the first time I've heard that clip. But as far as the first clip, I agree with that. I mean, you go back to 2021 and the policies that shifted, inheriting such maximum pressure leverage on Iran and the squeeze that had been put on all of its terror proxies. And of course, the pressure on Iran was allowed to dissipate. Now, is it impossible that it would just never have happened? We don't know. I mean, you can't just reinvent history. You don't know.
Of course, October 7th possibly would have happened anyway. Richard Goldberg, what about support for an Israeli annexation of the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians are by far the majority? Do you think a Trump administration would support that?
Well, if I look at the evidence, obviously, the Abraham Accords came together with a promise from then Prime Minister Netanyahu, obviously in his previous premiership, that Israel would not annex areas under Palestinian control under Oslo.
The Oslo Peace Accords, yeah.
And so I don't know that there was any change in policy in that respect. That is different, by the way, from saying that we are going to consider it inherently illegal for Jews to live in their historic biblical homeland. And then the question is sort of what is the end state that allows Palestinians to live self-sufficiently, not being dependent on UNRWA or other UN agencies, actually having economic opportunity, political opportunity, but also ensuring you don't have, you know, a rerun of Gaza only in the West Bank. So there has to be some sort of future end state where Palestinian aspirations are respected or supported, that they have political and economic opportunity, that the humanitarian situation is not just, you know, good, but great. At the same time, that the security dynamic is not one that favors Iran.
So, Richard Goldberg, let me get some clarification here. Would a second Trump administration encourage Israel to go to war with Iran? Like, would he back regime change there?
Well, I think important to remember, I don't speak for President Trump.
Of course.
You know, I speak as part of my analysis and my experience in the first administration and sort of my policy analysis. He has not articulated support for regime change that I have seen in the press. That doesn't mean that other actors in the region may not support that in the future. It doesn't mean that members of Congress don't support that. What he has expressed is a desire to put maximum pressure on the regime in Tehran and back Israel in whatever Israel judges is its security necessities to preserve its existence. If Israel is going to respond to a strategic level ballistic missile attack on its territory and degrade a lot of Iran's capabilities, it is in America's interest to support them in that effort.
That's Richard Goldberg. He served on the National Security Council during the Trump administration. Earlier this hour, we heard from a supporter and former advisor to Kamala Harris. Find more reporting on the impact of the U.S. election on global affairs at our website, theworld.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Noor Hall and Roger Hale, Lisa and Peter Krause, Carla Martin, Frank Washington, and Lizzie and Daniel Routman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.